Well, how are you this morning? All right, you look good. You look good. I don't have my I never have my glasses on. I'm sure you look good. When you and I explain the gospel to people, how we explain it depends in large part on how we read the story in Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. And that's where I'm going to focus this morning. But I'm going to begin somewhere surprising with the story of Moses. Can we have slide one, please? This is the earliest known photograph of Moses from when he was very young. That's from the movie Prince of Egypt, of course. And Moses, of course, was the person who led the tribe of Israel out of slavery in Egypt to the edge of the promised land. Now, Moses' childhood, once he'd been rescued by the Egyptian princess, was one of innocence and comfort and ease and privilege. He was a prince, the adopted son of the king. He didn't have to worry about anything. He had everything he could wish for. What an awesome way to begin your life. And then he grows up, and he comes to a place of responsibility. And all of a sudden, there is a dissonance in his life. There's a discomfort, a discord. Because he becomes aware of the difference between those with power, the Egyptians, his family, and those being oppressed and used as slaves, his biological family, the Hebrews. And where did he fit in that story? He comes to a point where he has to think, how does he see himself? Who will he be? And where will he position himself in that story? And then one day Moses makes a decision in which he sets himself up as a leader, as a judge over two Hebrews who were having a barney with someone, who were having a fight. "Who made you our leader?" they said. And in that confrontation, Moses kills somebody. And all of a sudden, Moses is now not in a world of privilege anymore. He's in a world of consequences. Consequences that break his relationship with his father. Consequences that remove him from privilege, that exile him from his land and from his life of ease, and propel him into a hard life, a life where he has to work for his survival, where he has to work as a shepherd, the lowest of the low in the society of that day. From that point on, the story doesn't change for years and years and years, until the grace of God transforms his story. That's an interesting story arc, isn't it? Beginning with innocence and comfort and ease and privilege, and then a time of dissonance and decisions, and then consequences, broken relationships, removal from privilege, exile from ease, a life of hard yakka, only to be transformed by the grace of God. Just take a look at that story arc for a moment. There's something strangely universal about that story. Moses is not the only person whose life describes that story arc. He's not the only human being whose life follows that curve. For instance, just think about Moses' great uncle, a guy called Joseph, one of the sons of Israel. Could we have slide 2, please? Joseph, consider his story. He grew up in a place of comfort and ease and privilege. So much so, he didn't have to go out and work in the fields with his brothers because he was the favored son, swanning around at home in his multicolored dream coat, his ornamental robes. Innocent. What an innocent life. Naive, in fact. Naive of the problems this might cause his hardworking brothers, who might not be so happy with this unequal arrangement. And then some dissonance enters his life. Here comes Dream Boy, say his brothers when they see him. Then come some decisions in his life. And Joseph begins to understand the difference between privilege and power and a life of hard yakka. And he knows where he sees himself in that picture. And it's not in the life of hard yakka. In fact, he's had dreams that tell him he will be set up as a leader for the tribe. And one of his bad decisions is to mention this a couple of times to his brothers, who aren't as excited as he is about the dreams. "You're going to rule over us," say his brothers and his dad. And now come some consequences. And you know the story. These consequences break his relationship with his father. They remove him from his place of privilege. They strip him of his ornamental robe. He is exiled from his homeland, removed from his life of ease, sent to Egypt to a life of hard yakka as a slave. That's worse than a shepherd. And then as a prisoner. That's the lowest of the low. And the story doesn't change for years and years and years until the grace of God transforms it. That's a familiar sounding story arc, isn't it? Let's look at slide 3. This story arc that begins with innocence, and then there's dissonance and discord and decisions and consequences to be transformed by the grace of God. This story seems to be a story not just of one person. It's a story that repeats. And as you look at that storyline, maybe some of us can look at that storyline and think, I can fit my life onto that storyline. Now, for some of us, if there's abuse or dysfunction in the family that we grow up in, that dissonance and discomfort and decisions about how we see ourselves may come quite early in the story. For some of us, it may come later as we enter the world of work. But might it be that this story is really a universal story? Could it be that this story is really the story of all of us? But geez Louise, if that's true, if this is a universal storyline, if this is the human story, who would volunteer for that? Who would choose to begin with privilege and ease and comfort and then choose to identify with those at the bottom of the pile? Who would choose to be a shepherd? Who would choose to take the form of a servant and face the consequences of those choices and take on a life of suffering voluntarily and depend only on the grace of God to transform the story? Who would voluntarily take on the story of all of us, if that's what it is? Did you hear of a guy called Jesus? Jesus did exactly that. He took on the story of all of us to transform it with the grace of God. Now, if that's right, if this is the story of all of us, where do we first encounter it? The answer is in Genesis chapter 2 and 3. It is the story of Adam and Eve. And so we're going to read it in Genesis chapter 2, beginning at verse 15, and we're going to go through into Genesis 3, the story of what we call the fall. But before we read the story, I want to give you a quick reminder from last time, so you know how to listen, that the word Adam, before it became a name, the word Adam means earthling. So we're going to read the story of the earthling. And the word Eve, before it became a name, means the living. So the story we're going to read is the story of the living. The moment you translate the names, you have the clues that you are reading the story of all of us. So if you have a Bible or an app, we're going to Genesis chapter 2. We're going to begin at verse 15. Yahweh God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And Yahweh God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die." Yahweh God said, "It is not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him." Now Yahweh God had formed out of the ground, that's interesting, same way as he did Adam, formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. So the man gave names to all the livestock, the birds of the air, and all the beasts of the field. But for the earthling, no suitable helper was found. So Yahweh God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep. And while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and closed up the place with flesh. Then Yahweh God fashioned a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man and brought her to the man. And the man said, "Wow, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She will be called woman, for she was taken out of man." For this reason, because of the wow, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. There is the innocence. There is the innocence and ease at the beginning of the story. Chapter 3, verse 1. Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals Yahweh God had made. Here is a note of dissonance. Something's going to happen. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree of the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die." "You will not surely die," the serpent said to the woman. "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." oh, well, now we've got some decisions to be made. Where does Eve see them on this grid? When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. Here's the beginning of the consequences. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of Yahweh God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Lord. They hid from him among the trees of the garden. But Yahweh God called to the man, "Where are you?" He answered, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" The man said, "The woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from that tree, and I ate it." Then Yahweh God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." So Yahweh God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all the livestock and all the wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel." To the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." To Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground. For from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return." Adam named his wife Eve because she would become the mother of all the living. Yahweh God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife. Here's grace. Even in this part of the story, the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. And Yahweh God said, "The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever." So Yahweh God banished him from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he had been taken. After he drove the man out, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life. So here is the story of Adam and Eve. Beginning in innocence, then come dissonance, decisions, consequences, and a glimpse of the grace of God. It is a story told for us, told to describe us to ourselves, told to explain our world to us. It's the story of human beings, our relationship with God, and our need for His grace. Because it is a universal story, the story of all of us, it's a story that should give us a great sense of unity with every human being on the planet. We are all on the same story arc. All of us, sons and daughters of Adam, all of us, sons and daughters of Eve, all of us in the same world of consequences. All needing the same grace from the same Creator and Father. And that awareness should really shape how we see people and how we feel about people. And it should shape how we understand and share the gospel. Because I think in the past, we've sometimes told the gospel as if to say, you need saving, and you are hellbound, and you need Jesus because of something somebody else did in a land far, far away, a guy called Adam, thousands of years ago in a garden called Eden. And because of his actions, you're going to hell, you're damned, and you need saving. Well, to quote Owen Wilson, wow. Is that how angry God got? That he never forgave Adam and you're paying the price for it now? How does that fit? How does that fit with what the Bible says about the new covenant? 800 years before Jesus, the book of the prophet Elijah said this. This is God speaking. In those days, people will no longer say, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. No, each one will die for his own sin. Whoever eats sour grapes, his own teeth will be set on edge. No more dying because of something an ancestor did. 600 years before Jesus, the prophet Ezekiel spoke the same truth. In Ezekiel chapter 18, you can hear God say this. Suppose there is a man who does what is just and right, who follows my decrees and faithfully keeps my laws. That man is righteous and will surely live. The soul who sins is the one who dies. So what do you people mean to quote this proverb? The fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, no longer quote this proverb in Israel. So we can't read Genesis 2 and 3 and say, you are damned and you need saving because of something your ancestor did in the Garden of Eden. Jeremiah and Ezekiel rule that out. God's prophetic word rules it out. No, you and I need the grace of God. You and I need saving. Because we live like Eve lived. Because we are earthlings like Adam was. Because their story is our story. Because our lives are on the same story arc. We're all sons and daughters of Adam. All sons and daughters of Eve. We begin in innocence. And then we reach an age of responsibility and decision making. And not all our decisions are good. And soon we're living in a world of consequences of our own making. Consequences in our relationship with God. Consequences in our relationship with others. All of us can be passive and make mistakes as Adam did. Or be driven by peer pressure, as Adam was. All of us can form into blaming and trying to avoid responsibility, as Adam and Eve did. All of us can get detached from the will of God, get confused by other voices, or forget or disobey what God has shown of us. We all can want wrong things and believe and do wrong things. We all do the things Adam and Eve did, because we are all living earthlings. Ours is the same human condition. All of us have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. We all, like sheep, have gone astray, each one to his own way. We're all part of the same story, needing the grace of God, needing the saving love of the same Father. The gospel puts us all into the same picture. In that sense, the gospel, Genesis 2 and 3, these are stories that unite us with every human being on the planet. I wonder if we tell it that way. Now, the stories of beginnings that we find in Genesis 1 to 11 take us from an unimaginable world, from a wonderful Eden, and then track a whole number of changes until, in Genesis 12, we are in the world that you and I know. And those changes, beginning in Genesis 3, are what we sometimes refer to as the fall. And we're going to map those changes out on this next slide, slide 4. So in Genesis 3, we see a change from innocence to responsibility and consequences. We see a change from nakedness to self-consciousness and covering up. We see a change from human harmony to a place of gender conflict and blame games. We see a change from a life of ease to a life of pain and hard yakka. We see a change from mortality with a cure to plain mortality. And then in Genesis 4, we see a change from human harmony to a world of competition and jealousy and murder and death and enmity between people groups. And then in Genesis 6, we see a change from human harmony to a strange situation that's really not explained, but something interferes with the human gene pool. And that's why there's a repopulation that God initiates. And we see a change from longevity to a life that maxes out at 120 years, just to give you advance notice. In Genesis 9, we see a change from harmony with nature and harmony with the animals to a world where we eat animals and animals eat us. In Genesis 9, we see a change from a sibling society to a world of oppressors and slaves, a world of haves and have-nots. And then in Genesis 10, we see a change from humanity being all together to the separation of cultures and languages. Then in Genesis 11, there's another story that takes us from humanity altogether to the separation of people groups, the extinction of a civilization, the separation of languages, and we reach a point where people can't understand each other. And by the time we get to people can't understand each other, we're in the modern world, the world of 2018. Now, every one of those changes is a story worth studying. They all get a separate scroll, I reckon, in this sweep from Genesis 3 to Genesis 11. But did you notice there's something missing from that list that a lot of people think is in the story of the fall? And it isn't. And this is the thing that is not in the story of the fall in Genesis on the next slide. This is what Genesis does not say. Before the fall, humans were inherently good. Human nature was essentially good. After the fall, humans became inherently bad. The fall changed human nature into a sinful nature, incapable of doing anything good. That is nowhere in the story of Genesis. That doctrine is nowhere in the stories of beginnings in the book of Genesis. And just note that the bad decisions that Adam and Eve made, other than giving names to the animals, they are the first human decisions ever mentioned, and they happen before the fall. That change in nature is not part of the story. It is not there. Now, why does that matter? Why does that matter? It matters because when Christians believe that, it takes us to a place where we believe that we can only find the image of God in other Christians who've had their sinful nature fixed. If that is true, that human nature has been turned all bad, then until a person becomes a Christian, they've got nothing good in them and nothing good to offer. Their nature is all bad. If I believe that, I can't really love and admire and respect a non-Christian because they're inherently bad, incapable of anything good. If I believe that about humanity, then I can't learn anything from a non-Christian. I can't learn anything from a non-Christian teacher. I can't learn anything from a non-Christian culture because they're incapable of anything good. It's not hard to see how you get from that belief to flat earth believing, Muslim hating, science denying, education fearing narrowness through believing that only the redeemed, only the Christian world has anything good or true or worthy to contribute, because everything else is fallen and corrupt and inherently bad and incapable of anything good. That's why it's important we get the story beginnings right, why we read the story closely. And that's just one of the problems that flows from believing that. Try and fit Jesus into that story. Doesn't work. He can't become one of us. He can't take his nature, our nature, on himself. If we get Genesis wrong, we get the gospel wrong. But it's not a story that is there in Genesis. What we have in Genesis are stories that unite us as human beings, because they are stories about all of us. Any person of any culture can read the scrolls of Genesis 1 to 11 and find themselves in the stories. Now, brothers and sisters, we live in a very ugly time right now. We live in a time when politicians and media and social media are creating a climate where we are made fearful of those who are different to us, where we are made hateful towards those who disagree with us, where I have nothing to receive or learn from you if you are of a different culture, or you look different, or you sound different. We have slide 6. But these stories of our beginnings, these scrolls brought together from Genesis 1 to Genesis 11, they're stories of a shared humanity, a shared story, a shared experience. And they are stories that reflect a shared longing across all cultures for what we feel has been lost. And so I'm going to look at that list again, beginning in Genesis 11 and working back. These stories only work only resonate with us if we feel these longings. And the writers are banking on every reader through all of time sharing these longings. These stories echo a shared longing for mutual understanding, a longing for peace between cultures, a longing for social equity, and I'm working my way up the list, a longing for harmony with nature, a longing for a long and healthy life, a longing for a recovery of humanity, a longing for an end to killing and murder, a longing for collaboration and peace between people groups, a longing for love and support for the dying and healing for those in pain, a longing for support and relief for the hardworking and the enslaved, a longing for harmony between the genders and for a clarity of conscience and innocence for our children. The writers clearly expect every reader through all time to resonate with those longings. And these longings are as relevant today as they ever were. These stories are there to draw out our love for people and our longing for unity as a human race. Drawing out our love in a way our world desperately needs. I'm going to finish by putting the question to you. If we can go back to, I think it was slide 3 with that story arc. Where are you in the story? If you're very young, you might still be in that place of innocence. Or are you in a world of dissonance and discord? Are you in a place of decision-making about who you are, where you see yourself in the picture? Are you in a world of consequences that confront you from day to day, consequences that you are wrestling with, trying to get out of, trying to fix? Or are you in a place where your story is being transformed by the grace of God? The God who created the world, the God of Adam and Eve, loves us, has grace to transform our stories. And maybe some here are in that place where you're really crying out for that grace. Grace to change your story. Grace to set you in the right place. Grace for healing. Grace that will give you restoration where there's been pain. Grace that will heal a broken relationship that's been hurt. Which is it for you? Let's stand and pray.